Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. One of the great things about being at the Conservative Political Action Conference here in Orlando, Florida, is the best people are here. And one of them is sitting across from me now. His name is Peter Schweitzer, an old friend, friend of many years is what
yes,
because you're not actually all that old. But he has done absolutely incalculably important work for decades. Through a whole host of books and all that flow from them, notably about my old friend and boss, much admired leader, Ronald Reagan, of
absolutely,
course.
Absolutely, yes.
I think one of the best was Victory.
Yes, thank you.
Your first?
Yes, yes.
Fabulous book.
Thank you.
But more recently, incredible truth-telling about corruption in our political system and its implications for America. The most recent of which is Red Handed, in which he talks about how the Chinese communists have effectively achieved their goal of elite capture.
Right.
And the harm that is doing to our country. Hard to overstate how important this is, Peter, especially at this moment when we're watching the Chinese clearly emboldened by what they've secured in the way of elite capture. Tell us about your research and the important takeaways from it.
Well, Frank, I know that you've been watching the world stage for quite a long time. I have as well. And, you know, there's so many actions that the CCP has taken on the global stage. And I always wondered why the United States is not taking a more proactive position in countering it. And what I realized is they have this strategy, they write about it openly, of elite capture. And it's brilliant if you think about it. Rather than go head-to-head with the United States, we're going to just basically buy off elements of its leadership class, both political parties, people on Wall Street, people in Silicon Valley, people in Washington, D.C., and we're going to effectively decapitate their leadership by doing so. So that is elite capture. And it's important to point out, Frank, is they're not expecting these people they've captured to be robots. They understand they need political viability. So what they're looking for, loosely translated to English, is big help with a little bad mouth. So if you want to ding us on the Uyghurs, if you want to talk about human rights or Taiwan a little bit, that's okay. As long as you give us what we want, which is
access.
Yeah, exactly. The big things. Technology, access to markets, free trade. As long as you give us those
financing.
Financing, exactly. If you give us those things, you can pop off about the Uyghurs. We don't really care because ultimately we're going to win. And that's where we are.
And we know it doesn't really matter because, as far as we're concerned, it is the little things. Which brings us to the question of the moment, Peter, which is, are they persuaded on the basis of the degree to which they have penetrated, subverted, and captured our elites, especially against the backdrop of Afghanistan and now Ukraine, that they can act with impunity against Taiwan, who knows, perhaps India, maybe even other of our friends, allies, and interests, or even us?
Yeah, I mean, that's the fear. And I think, actually, you probably have a better sense of their strategic assessment than I do, because I sort of look at the nuts and bolts. But you just look at the recent news today. You know, Russian forces are lined up to go against Ukraine. And the United States has, of course, world-class intelligence. And the Biden administration says, oh, we're going to share this with China, because, of course, China's going to want to stop Putin from doing this. And of course, they didn't. The Chinese actually shared it with the Russians. I mean, it's a comedy show.
But
if it weren't so
tragic. But we can work with them on global climate change, right?
Exactly. You know, even in climate change, by the way the Biden administration's going about it, saying we want everybody buying solar panels, doing renewables, which there's nothing wrong with it. But when you look at the alignment, they just took tariffs off of Chinese solar panels. So people are going to be buying Chinese solar panels. This is going to be a massive...
And batteries.
Yes, and batteries. This is going to be a massive boon to the CCP.
Yeah. And I guess this is the thing that is so aggravating, is the dots don't seem to be being connected as much as they should. Peter, I mean, you're doing your job, needless to say. And I do feel as though there's a growing sense within certain influential sectors, thinking the victims of communism, for example, which has recently done a report, I think, similarly minded by yours.
Yep.
And our friend Roger Robinson, of course, has been at it with the Coalition for, what does it call it, Prosperous America?
Yeah.
Our Committee on the Present Danger, China. I mean, I think there's a growing cadre of people led by you, really, coming forward with this information. But do you sense that it's penetrating to the public, which you'd think that it would be bad enough that we've been subjected to a biological warfare attack by these guys who've killed whatever it is now, 700,000 of us or more.
Right.
And yet the connections don't seem to be being made yet to the point where action is going to be taken as it needs to be.
I think the public's ahead of the leadership class, the political class. Yes, I you know, my experience with the book, the book came out a month ago, first 3 weeks, number one on the list, fourth week, number two on the list. Yeah, but I see that as a testament that people do see this. I think people have wondered for a while, why do we see so many people in corporate America in Washington, D.C., not responding to what China does. So I feel there's awakening going on. I think the great work that you and Roger and others are doing is so important, and people are starting to become alert to it. But we've got to continue it so it reaches a critical mass to where we either shame our political leaders into taking action or we replace them.
Right. Praise God. I think you're absolutely right about certainly the prescription. Let me hone in on the finance piece, because as you know, we've been spending an awful lot of time trying to see if we can't replicate something that you described, basically, in Victory. Roger's war plan for Ronald Reagan on economic warfare as an instrument for taking down the last totalitarian communist regime that sought our destruction. There are individuals like Larry Fink, who you feature prominently in the book, and others, State Street and Vanguard and so on, that have been not only investing in our enemy, including the People's Liberation Army itself.
Correct.
But they're doing it with our money.
Right, right.
And this is the thing that I think if you're right that the public is now aroused, if we can just make the case to them that I'm fond of the old network movie, which you may remember. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Right?
That's what we need on this financial piece. And if we were to do that, Peter, don't you think that this would make an impact on their ability to do the various malevolent things they're doing, including corrupting our elite?
And so I'm going to make a confession to you here on the air. So I've been studying this stuff. I've listened to Roger and the work that you've done. About 5 or 6 months ago, I looked at my 401k investment account, as small and meagerly as it is, and I thought, well, I'm not investing in Chinese companies. I don't know individual stocks. I looked at, it was a Fidelity developing world, emerging economies.
Global markets.
Yeah, global markets fund. 35 to 40% of the companies in that fund were Chinese companies. So what I would say is to the audience out there, do a serious assessment. If you are invested in an emerging markets fund or a world fund, the odds are overwhelming that you own parts of Chinese companies. And these Chinese companies are not making potato chips. They are making computer chips, and they are making components for weapon systems that are aimed at us. So everybody has to check it. I checked it and was shocked at what I found.
Yeah, and at Committee on the Present Danger China, presentdangerchina.org, we're working on a campaign we call the Mad as Hell campaign to try to help people do just that, Peter. So we'd love to work with you on it, too.
Yeah.
Just a closing thought on this. Knowing what you do about how the Chinese operate, one of the things Roger Robinson has often commented about is the danger that we could find as a result of the investments we've made, mostly unwittingly, in China, that we are actually incentivized to ensure that there isn't any difficulty with China.
Right.
He says, you know, this is putting the China lobby
absolutely
on steroids.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a danger?
I think it's a very real danger, because here's the thing. Remember, the entire premise of what they call engagement with China was that we would be wedded together. China would mellow. It would influence their behavior patterns because of this connection. The opposite's happened. It's changing our behavior patterns because of this economic bond, and that's got to change. Thanks, Frank.
Peter Schweitzer, thank you.
Great,
God bless you
here
for your work. Come back for a longer chat if you want.
Absolutely. I'd love to. Thanks, brother.
Talk to you soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I am thrilled to be able to say we are back with a good friend, a man I have come to admire tremendously, David Clements. He has been a prosecutor in his native state of New Mexico. He has been a professor at the State University Law School. He has been a champion of election integrity, having been a victim of election fraud himself in a Senate race out in New Mexico. He took on, after the 2020 debacle, a concerted effort to get to the ground truth about what actually happened to President Donald Trump. Among other things, investigating assiduously affidavits that had been assembled from all across the country that persuasively made the case, as a former prosecutor, that there was fraud, there was malfeasance, there was criminal misconduct. And ever since I've met him, I have admired him, and never more so than at the present moment. We're delighted to have him with us here at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando, Florida. David Clements, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Hey, Frank. Good to be with you, and I'm glad that I still have your admiration. The list seems like Absolutely. It's getting smaller and smaller as I fight this battle.
You are an acquired taste, my friend, as am I, and I have acquired it, so you're not going to shake me easily. Let's talk a little bit about something that you have turned your considerable talents to in recent months, namely trying to get forensic audits underway in every state across the country, a huge undertaking. How's it going?
It is one of the most frustrating and difficult things I've ever endeavored to get involved with, because it's not we the people that lack passion in getting to the truth. It's these political bottlenecks that we run into. And in the urban areas where you've got a concentration of power, no one will let us look at the machines. No one will let us do the canvas.
Now, these wouldn't be Republicans by any chance.
In some respects, it's the Republicans that are more hostile than the Democrats.
No kidding.
And, but we've had some breakthroughs. As frustrating as it is, in Otero County, New Mexico, we prevailed upon a county commission who unanimously approved a full forensic audit there. And so we've been canvassing over the past 3 weeks. We'll have access to the machines, but we're getting threats. Brian Cologne, who's running for attorney general, he's a Democrat, has opened an inquiry. We've gotten some nasty grams accusing us of racism, even though there's
naturally,
right?
Default setting for all accusers.
But the canvas results thus far, we've gone to over 1,000 addresses, and over, I want to say, 40% of the voter rolls are off. 40%. Now, we can break it down in categories. You get 29% where they're just, it's simply inaccurate. Those people don't live there anymore. We had 6%, I want to say, lost votes. These are people that swear up and down that they voted on November 3rd, 2020, and their vote is not reflected on the voter rolls. We've got 2% phantom votes. At least 12% of what we're seeing is absolutely machine-driven. And we're getting no cooperation from any of the politicians there. So this is a ground-up movement.
When you're saying a lack of cooperation, that's one thing. Are you also experiencing active opposition and subversion and other obstructionism?
It is. If you go into this process thinking that folks will work with you in good faith, you've got another thing coming. We've got courageous county commissioners, and that's about it. Everyone else is dead set against us getting to the truth. Our goal is to decertify the elections in that county, or we'll take this as well, have a no confidence vote in the machines and hold a paper election in the primary. And my vision for the country is if we can
find... Is there still time to do that?
Well, it's getting shorter. May. We got until May. So there's some time, but it's running out. But my goal is to get into at least all 50 states, find one county where we can get rid of the machines and start contrasting the results from corrupt election machines versus a true paper election. I think you're going to see wild anomalies between the two. We've learned a lot of lessons.
So when you say you think, that's based on now
well,
hard
right now,
evidence?
We already have enough to decertify. This is what's difficult is everyone wants 100% proof, but in the process, they won't give us the very things that we need to give
Funny
them.
How that works.
Yes. So we're a little bit wiser. New Mexico is leading the way, and it's odd because we're one of these backward states that everyone forgets about. And we've learned a lot of lessons out of what not to do from Maricopa County. A lot of folks were excited, myself promoting, and I've been on your show many times saying, let's get that domino to fall. And what we saw was a level of cowardice and infiltration that really left us with a report that was incomprehensible in many ways. The routers and spunk locks would have told us a lot. Those were never turned over. A canvas, an official canvas authorized by the Senate, was never approved because of Merrick Garland and threats from the DOJ. And then you had actors that were put in place by Patrick Byrne and the America Project that, to this day, I'm scratching my head why these folks were there. Doug Logan of Cyber Ninjas, his company's now defunct. They were held in contempt. Now, Patrick Byrne went on record saying that he thought that Doug Logan was incompetent. But then he turned around and paid him $5 million to oversee the audit. Dr. Shiva, shining light, an expert's expert, was given corrupted ballot images when they had the intact images in place and wasn't given what he needed until 2 months after the audit was completed. So when we do our postmortem, we're going, this is either gross incompetence or it was purposeful to basically have a version of political theater where we all think that we're solving a problem and we're just scratching our head right now. So New Mexico is, if I have anything to do with it, will try to be the antithesis of what we saw in Maricopa. Lean, tight, it's not for the cameras. This is just to get to the truth and we can move on.
And how far along are you in that process?
We're 3 weeks in. And
how long do you think it should take?
It won't take much longer if we can get the machines. We're getting interference. So the latest nastygram was from the Secretary of State saying, if you touch the machines, we will decommission them. And I'm sitting there going, well, you had me at decommission. Just don't replace them with any more corrupt election machines. Mm-hmm. But there's a standoff right now. So we expect there will probably be challenges. But the work that we need to do with those machines probably won't take more than 2 days. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of getting in and getting out.
Well, David, Godspeed in this mission. I can only tell you as one citizen who cares powerfully that we have free and fair elections going forward, I'm very much of the view, as many of us are, that you can't get there from here unless you've figured out how have previous ones been interfered with and made unfree, unfair, and as a result, corrupted. I wanted to just take a couple minutes before we have to let you go, talking about something that we happen to have here in the, well, you can't call it flesh, I guess, but an actual copy of something we spoke with you about previously in the abstract. I call it the game. Introduce it, if you would, and explain what it is.
Yeah, so after that depressing update about the state of affairs, we all need a drink, and sometimes when you have a nice drink, you can play a board game to relax, and this is what this is. This is an election fraud board game. And the concept
And what's
is,
it called?
Election 2020, You Decide. You can find it at electionfun.com. And the best way I could describe this is it's Trivial Pursuit meets the Babylon Bee. A lot of satire. And the goal is for the red team and the blue team to try to acquire electoral votes. And you do that traversing the board. And once you get to a certain number, you get to go from the outside game to the inside game. And corruption, lying, obstacles, getting triggered, being sent to safe spaces is all built into the game. And I think what sets this apart from every game that I've come across is the QR code technology, where with on the cards themselves, on the box here, you can pull up these rich digital postcards with media just stuffed in there. And you don't have to rely on Facebook doing your fact checking for you. You can just go to the sources, watch the videos for yourself. And it's not just the election. It really is a time capsule of 2020, whether it's the summer of love, as we call it, with Portland, Kenosha, Minneapolis, the COVID hoax, election fraud, and some of the political blunders that you'd expect with Hunter Biden and his father.
Yeah. And not least, Tony Fauci and the coronavirus is another story. And I love this thing. Friends of mine have been involved in it. You have too. And I'm a huge supporter of it. It is a very clever, entertaining, engaging way to, well, I call it de-gaslight the American people about all of the things they've been lied to, lied about, and essentially equip them, going back to what we were just talking about, equip them to make better, you know, choices and understand how important those choices actually are in the elections to come. Whichever party you favor or candidate, this is a way of sort of, well, I think of it as healing, in part, what has happened to our country over so many of these topics. And, you know, it's to make a crude analogy, it's kind of like a festering sore on so many of these fronts. We're never going to heal. We're never going to get past the divisions that are tearing us apart. If we can't, ideally, in a fun way, get down to the truth. And I think that what David, you and our friends involved in the game, and people can find out how to get their hands on it at electionfun.com.
That's right.
Are making a real contribution to hopefully the healing that we all hope to have.
I hope so. I mean, there's been a lot of crying over the past 2 years. It'd be nice if we saw a little bit more laughter. And it's cathartic. You know, a lot of the stuff that's in this game, it's depressing, but it's done in a way, again, like most people that are familiar with Babylon Bee. The satire is so true.
Yes.
That, you know, sometimes we're finding that the greater truths you can find through humor. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the game. I'm proud of what it can teach folks in a very unconventional way. I think we've talked about in the past, we lament how conservatives aren't very good at having fun.
Right.
And so I think this will accomplish the substantive thing that we love, which is to teach and learn, but have it in a nice, fun package.
Electionfun.com. Thank you for bringing it to CPAC, and thank you for all the work that you've done to bring it to fruition. And I think it's going to be a very lasting contribution. And I hope the American people will, in fact, benefit from it at a moment like this when it's so urgent and needed. Mm-hmm. God bless you. David Clements, keep up the great work. Come back to us again very soon,
Frank,
if you would. Take good care. Next up, we'll speak with Trevor Loudon. We'll capture some of his thoughts on the problem of the enemy within, specifically within the church.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. While the world's attention is focused on Russia's aggression against Ukraine, the likelihood grows that ominous conflicts will erupt elsewhere as well. The obvious one will involve the Chinese communists moving against Taiwan, either directly and forcefully or via a flanking maneuver, blockade, or other coercive non-kinetic techniques, including cyber, information, and economic warfare. In addition, even as Vladimir Putin pursues his Ukrainian invasion, he has put a large naval force into the eastern Mediterranean. This may be an indicator that hostilities are imminent between Israel and one or both of the Kremlin's regional clients, Iran and Syria. Such a prospect is another reason, if any were needed, for Team Biden to abandon its appalling appeasement of the mullahs. The idea of giving them still more billions for additional empty promises to abandon their nuclear ambitions is not just reckless, it's insane. This is Frank Affney.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Well, here we are at the Conservative Political Action Conference, and some of the best people in the country are here, and one of them is sitting across the table from me, and I couldn't be more proud to have him joining us once again. He is a fairly regular contributor to our programming, and it's always one of the highlights of my day, my week, my month, my year, when we have a chance to talk with the great Trevor Loudon. Trevor Loudon is, of course, an accomplished author, essayist, filmmaker, and extraordinary national treasure, I'm going to say, or maybe binational treasure, hailing originally from New Zealand, but he has come to the United States to live and hopefully rescue us from the perils of what has befallen his native land, and some of the bad guys seem to have in mind for us as well. His latest product, of which I am extremely proud, is The Enemies Within the Church, a film about a topic he knows perhaps better than just about anybody else, namely the subversive elements that seek to take down our country and its institutions. Focused, of course, specifically on the theological institutions of our country. It's a stunning film. It's exceedingly well done. And kudos to Trevor Loudon and his production team for pulling it off. I know you've put an enormous amount of effort into it, Trevor, and it definitely bears the fruit of it.
Well, thanks so much for the kind words, Frank. That's great.
Before we're done, we're going to ask you how people can get their hands on it. But let's start with a little bit more detail about the thesis behind the film, Trevor. I think most people, perhaps not in this audience, but in America, assume that churches are somehow inured, separate from, and untrammeled by politics or ideology. That's not so.
Unfortunately, that's not the case, Frank. You know, the enemies of America decided a long time ago that you could never take America from the outside. You had to do it from the inside. And they understood that the churches were the backbone of this country. The very first Communist Party front in America was the Methodist Committee for Social Action. They were inside the churches from the 1920s onwards. So our movie traces the genesis of this back to the old Communist Party days of the 20s and the 30s and 40s, right up to the so-called woke movement of today. Now, wokeism is Marxism. It's social justice. It's critical race theory. It is white privilege. All of these are Marxist concepts. And the idea is that the church is another institution that must be conquered for Marxism. It's the last stand. If the churches fall, the whole culture will move to the left and the politics will move irrevocably to the left. So this is, the church has been targeted just like Hollywood was targeted. The unions were targeted. Political parties have been targeted. Big tech has been targeted. And this movie will shock people at how deeply even the evangelical churches, even the Southern Baptists, have been penetrated by bona fide atheistic Marxists.
Used an interesting formulation there. If the church were to succumb to this, bad things would happen. You actually document that it has. Not obviously every single church or even every single seminary, I guess, or denomination, but chunks of them for sure. And
absolutely.
Give us a sense of the scale of what you found.
Well, what we've found is that the most of the Bible colleges and the seminaries and large Christian evangelical institutions have been heavily penetrated. And I'm talking, you know, rock solid Christian seminaries are now preaching Marxism. And so the pastors who once would have come out and been rock solid for Ronald Reagan and supported Israel and the Constitution and free enterprise are now hardcore Bernie Sanders, Palestine, socialist supporters. And this is going to translate to the politics of the country.
Absolutely.
And these are the people who elected Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. And now they're going to the left.
One of the things that I've concluded based on mostly rocks you've kicked over and examined what's underneath them, is that George Soros is somewhere in the mix. Yep. Is there any evidence that he has been enabling this penetration, subversion, and takedown, as he has so many other of our institutions?
Well, he's involved in many ways. One of the most obvious is that one of the big Marxist pushes in this country is to open the borders, flood the country with illegal immigrants to create social chaos and a large democratic voting base for the left in politics. George Soros has funded the Evangelical Immigration Roundtable, which is people like Russell Moore, who was head of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. So Soros money has gone into evangelical churches to move them in certain directions on immigration policy and others. The big Martin Luther King MLK 50 festival, that was done by evangelicals a couple of years ago, was also heavily funded by Soros. The idea being, emphasize issues of race. They're obsessed with race because the old communists wanted to divide us on class lines. That doesn't work very well in America. So the new communists are dividing us on race lines. So yes, Soros money is heavily invested in many evangelical fields today.
You have, of course, focused considerable attention on the enemy within, but in the process, you've also done fantastic work, Trevor Loudon, documenting the extent to which enemies without are involved as well. A specific focus of effort, appropriately, has been the Chinese Communist Party.
Yep.
Talk about any role that they may be playing in this kind of subversive campaign. Atheistic they are, of course, but also are they United Front Work Department sort of entities involved here as well?
Look absolutely. But take it back a step. The Chinese Communist Party did a big 20-year study on America several years ago, and they wanted to know how America was strong. The basis, they said, first we thought it was the military, but it wasn't. Then we thought it was the government, but it wasn't. We are beyond doubt, they said, it is the church. The American church is what makes America strong. So if you want to destroy America, as communist China does, you would make sense for you to get involved in the church. And that, so we see movements like Black Lives Matter, which has been heavily endorsed by many Christian churches. That is a Chinese communist operation run out of the Chinese consulate in San Francisco, run by Liberation Road, a communist pro-Chinese communist organization. I'll give you another.
The Chinese Progressive Association
of San Francisco, Chinese communist. Well, a few years ago, in InterVarsity and these organizations have been taken over by Maoists and Campus Crusade for Christ. They're using actual Maoist communist literature in their indoctrination programs for their students. A few years ago, Michelle Higgins, a young black pastor from St. Louis, Missouri, was lecturing thousands of young evangelical Christians at an InterVarsity convention in Missouri. She told them they had to end white privilege. They had to end white privilege, a Maoist concept. They were not told she was a member of the Organization for Black Struggle. They front for the Liberation Road Chinese Communist Group that burnt Ferguson, Missouri to the ground in 2014. The Chinese are involved, actively involved on the ground in our politics, and that is seeping into the churches in a big way.
Are there people in the church community in America that recognize the danger that you've now documented, and are they engaging to try to contest this takedown of such a vital institution?
Absolutely. They are, and you saw a lot of these pastors, the same pastors who kept their church open when the Chinese ravaged this country with their COVID.
Biological warfare.
Which was biological warfare, exactly. And a lot of pastors kept their churches open, defied government, defied the government, stood on the First Amendment of the Constitution, etc. There are networks of pastors building who are actually working to take the churches back. They're contesting what is happening in the Southern Baptist. They're contesting what's happening in these the seminaries and the Bible colleges, etc. We did the movie to give these people more strength and to grow the ranks of this remnant that is fighting back so they can more readily identify the problem more readily identify the culprits and are clearer on what they have to do to fight back. Yeah. So we did this movie to help those people.
It's vital work, needless to say, as is your entire body of work, Trevor. And I really want to commend you, because I personally have learned so much from you in the revelations that you have been able to make about, well, the penetration of institution after institution. I think particularly of your masterwork, Enemies Within, the book and the movie, about our political system and the extent to which they have been deeply compromised as well. And I, just to, you know, sort of close this out, I'd like to ask you specifically about something I talked earlier with Congressman Jim Banks about, which is the impact on the Chinese Communist Party's calculations about what they can get away with respect to Taiwan, or with respect to, you know, Japan or the Philippines or Australia or who knows who all else, us, of having a man they own sitting in the White House.
Well, I say this, the three most powerful countries in the world right now are all run by communists. I'm talking Russia, China, and the United States. Russia is on the march. China's on the march. Iran is on the march. They see no opposition coming from the leadership of the United States. We had 4 years of peace under President Trump. The bad guys knew they didn't mess with Trump. Right. Okay. One election has changed the whole world balance of power. Afghanistan was, I believe, a deliberate ploy to hand that country to the Chinese with tons of American military technology with it. The Ukraine, we are now seeing, is going to change the whole balance of power in Europe if it's allowed to continue as its way. We are seeing a takedown of the West because we have such compromised leadership in the White House. It's absolutely critical that people understand what's at stake here.
I want to commend in this regard, in addition to the various, you know, work you're doing at the Epoch Times and podcasts and your movies and books, of course, the Accountability Initiative, yep, which you and Sam Faddis have principally populated with dossiers on individuals at the senior-most ranks of the United States government. And it's chilling reading to realize how compromised they are. And it is stupefying, I must say, as an old cold warrior, I guess, to realize that this is going largely unremarked, let alone challenged, to say nothing of prosecuted.
Well, that's right. You know, the Republicans should be on the case. And the Republicans are voting for people who couldn't pass a background check to drive a school bus.
Yes.
They're voting them onto major committees, major institutions, not challenging them. Virtually the entire Biden cabinet has ties to communist China.
No.
Many of our, you know, I say most of the chairmen of congressional committees in this country and Senate committees have ties to either communist China or the wider communist movement of this country.
Stubborn.
It is that bad, and nobody's holding these people to account except for works like the Accountability Initiative, etc. But this should be front page stuff at conferences like this in CPAC.
Sure.
We should be slamming and exposing these people. Instead, they've got people like Tulsi Gabbard here who should be the subject of investigation, not the not speaking at a conservative conference.
This is a topic to which we will return. Trevor Ludden, we have to let you go. Thank you for joining us here at the Conservative Political Action Conference and for your truth-telling, courageously and fearlessly.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we have yet another wonderful addition to our program today here at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando, Florida. His name is Dr. Sung Yun Lee. He is a professor at the Fletcher School of International Studies at Tufts University, a foreign-born American patriot, I call him, who has an appreciation of freedom that is unfortunately not widely enough shared by those of us who've had the privilege of growing up in this country. He came from South Korea. We're going to talk to him a bit about what's happening in his native land, as well as here in his adopted country. Doctor, it's great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start by talking with you about the topic that you addressed here at CPAC yesterday.
Yes.
and in a program that we did together a few weeks back that were focused principally on what is happening in South Korea at the moment with respect to the agenda of its president, Moon Jae-in, concerning something called the End of War Agreement. What can you tell us about this idea of his and the problems with it?
Well, the South Korean president, the outgoing President Moon, his term comes to an end in May, has been floating, not only floating, pushing really hard the United States to agree to sign something called an End of War Declaration with North Korea. What does that mean? Well, this idea was first floated in 2007 by a former South Korean president, President Roh Moo-hyun, for whom Moon was the chief of staff. In President Roh's meeting with Kim Jong-il, the father of the current North Korean dictator, in October 2007, the two Korean leaders signed a joint statement. Article 4 calls for the North and South signing an end-of-war declaration. What does it mean? There is no comparable case in international law. There is a peace treaty, there's a declaration of war and other things, armistice, ceasefire agreement. But what is an end-of-war declaration? It is a non-binding ploy, a prelude to signing a peace treaty. South Korea wants the U.S. to sign a peace treaty with North Korea. Now, peace, everyone wants peace. Not everyone, perhaps, but most of us. Peace sounds sweet. It's tantalizing. But in history, a peace treaty has, on occasion, been a canard, a ploy that brought war instead of peace. Once upon a time, in 1928, there was something called the Kellogg-Briand Pact. 15 nations signed it in 1928, including the US, the Soviet Union, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, Japan. You get my point? They all went to war in the next 12 or 13 years.
Which the pact was supposedly going to prohibit.
Renouncing war forever as an instrument of national policy, the party said. And then we remember, of course, in 1939, the Hitler-Stalin non-aggression pact, the Ribbentrop-Molotov joint statement non-aggression pact that led to war a year later. Then there is the infamous 1973 Paris Peace Accord, basically under which the U.S. abandoned South Vietnam after years of investment, human treasure, blood, you know, resources, paving the way for communization of Vietnam in 1975. So, a peace treaty, as wonderful as it sounds, can be the exact opposite of peace. North Korea, we know.
Especially if it isn't even a treaty. If it's just an agreement to have a treaty.
Exactly.
But you see, know the record of North Korea.
A peace treaty is a bit too hard to achieve right now. So the South Korean government is pushing for an end of war declaration, a feel-good move in moving toward eventually a peace treaty. But what would an end of war declaration achieve? It would call into question the raison d'etre of the UN command in South Korea, which was formed when North Korea invaded the South in June 1950. Under the UN command, 16 nations came to defend South Korea. That mechanic is still in place today. So if Kim Jong-un starts a war, we don't need to go through the UN right now. 16 nations will provide protection to South Korea and try to protect the flimsy but real peace that has existed over the past seven decades.
Most especially the United States with its forces
Absolutely.
On the ground there
Yes.
in support of
Yes.
South Korea's freedom.
Yes. So the people pushing for an end of war declaration and a peace treaty have something else in mind. Eviction of the United States troops from South Korea, which has long been a top priority for the North Korean regime. Render South Korea vulnerable to North Korea's censorship, bullying, and then what? Eventually take over the South. You know, President Trump, in his marvelous address to the South Korean National Assembly in November 2017, put it best. He said, the sheer existence of a free and prosperous South Korea threatens the existence of a closed and despotic North Korea. They say all politics is local, right? So if we apply that to Korea, you have a very successful, prosperous Korean state in the South, something entirely the opposite of that in the North. The fact that South Korea is a magnet to the people of North Korea is a long-term existential threat to the Kim regime. So they
which is all about
over.
Preserving its hold on power.
Of course.
First and foremost.
So this peace
and
treaty idea.
And then also, unfortunately, returning to a single unified peninsula under their dominion.
Of course.
And this is the thing that I think makes your warning so vitally important, Professor. And that is, if we recreate conditions in which they think they can actually get away with forcibly reunifying with the South, which is their stated intent, is there any doubt in your mind that they will, that Kim Jong-un specifically, will seize the opportunity to act aggressively?
People say, oh no, they won't start a war. How can you imagine a land war in the 21st century? There's so much prosperity in South Korea. We've had, you know, no war, a shaky peace, but real peace over the past 7 decades in the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has not overtly attacked the South in over 10 years now. So no way Kim Jong-un would risk perhaps losing his life in starting a war against the South. Really? Well, North Korea says in its constitution that the supreme national task is unification on its own terms. What does that mean? Take over the South. So, yes, North Korea is a nuclear power, it's a serial proliferator, it's the worst violator of human rights in the world. It has evil designs to take over the prosperous South. How would North Korea achieve that? Well, get the Americans out. Isolate South Korea, become a nuclear threat to the U.S. mainland, which North Korea has achieved already, and sign a peace treaty, get Americans out of South Korea, and then have their way with the South. It's a dangerous proposition.
It is risky business, to say the least. And as you're talking, one of the things that's, you know, rising to my mind is one might deprecate the prospects of a land war, but that's harder to do in the midst of what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. I'm of the view, and I'd be interested in your take on this, that unfortunately both what is taking place in Ukraine at the moment at the hands of the despotic Russians, who are allied with the North Koreans, by the way, is not only a distraction, but an opportunity for both the Chinese and, for sure, the North Koreans and perhaps the Iranians and others to pile on, to act aggressively in the expectation that we won't do anything more about them than we have about Ukraine, or if we even intend to, we can't because we're too badly distracted. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And when you read declassified NSC, CIA, White House documents from the late 60s, Americans assessed that North Korea was escalating starting in early 1968 under the correct premise that the United States could not afford to prosecute two wars simultaneously in East Asia against Vietnam and against North Korea. So they came out swinging. In January, North Korea sent an elite 31-man commando unit to assassinate the South Korean president. In the same month, North Korea seized the USS Pueblo and kept in captivity 80 crewmen, servicemen, torturing them. And at the same time, North Korea sent commandos who killed, massacred South Korean civilians. Next year, Nixon took office. On Kim Il-sung's birthday, April 15, North Korean jet shot down a U.S. spy plane in international airspace, killing all 31 servicemen, and so on. Killed more Americans that year in 1969 than all years before since the end of the Korean War. So North Korea will cause trouble under the present circumstances, with the Biden administration reeling from the embarrassment of the Afghanistan withdrawal, what's going on in Ukraine. the Cold War dynamics stay, they are in place where you have Russia, China, and North Korea on one side, and then on the other side, the US and the two democracies in the region, Japan and South Korea. So this is an opportune time for Beijing, for Moscow, for Pyongyang, to really push their agenda. It's a dangerous time.
It is a dangerous time, and I think in your panel yesterday, you described that danger as being exacerbated by the possible action of the United States Congress on a piece of legislation that embraces this idea of setting up, basically,
a peace treaty.
Well, inevitably, the withdrawal of American forces from the Korean Peninsula. Speak very quickly, if you would, Professor, about H.R. 3446, the so-called Peace on the Korean Peninsula Act.
Yes, the Korean Peninsula Peace Act, introduced in May in 2021, calls for the U.S. Secretary of State to immediately begin peace treaty negotiations with North Korea. I think the premise is sound, but it's quixotic. It's very idealistic and dangerously so. The notion that if we provide Kim Jong-un with a peace treaty, he'll somehow grow less paranoid, less defensive, come out beaming smiles, and no longer be a threat to the region, come on, please. It's dangerously idealistic in that it underestimates the North Korean leadership. It's patronizing. Maybe that's not the intention, but in the end, it is a dangerous miscalculation that will paradoxically, despite the peace, the word peace in the treaty, if it's ever signed, will bring war.
I think I would add the adjective that it is subversive to the ones you've used. I'm not sure whether that's the intent of
freedom
the legislators,
but I think it
is the effect.
And I don't think it's going to be signed into a law anytime soon, but there are about 30 supporters in Congress, mostly Democrats.
From your lips to God's ears, as they say, I hope you're right that it won't be.
That's why we need to raise awareness right now, you know,
exactly
at the early
point.
Stage.
This is why we've been so pleased to have you with us.
And, you know, peace is not self-executing. It doesn't just happen by itself. You have to enforce it, not with appeasement, but with containment, with deterrence, balance of power.
You need to work at it, and you need to cherish it in order to want to work at it.
Exactly.
And again, this is where I think your testimony is so important, your experience in a country that has known a lot.
Devastated by war.
Devastated by war.
Abject poverty, acute hunger, you know.
Especially as you see what's happening north of our border as we speak, in terms of the transformation of a freedom-loving nation like Canada so quickly into something that seems, well, more like North Korea than South Korea at the moment. It is terrifying, and therefore, again, your foreign-born American patriotism is all the more needed and deeply appreciated by us. I hope you'll come back to us with updates and color commentary on what's happening in North Asia. It's so vitally important.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Great work.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.